Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills, overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They have to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls out across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Give us a call if you have a question, if you have a comment, because this is really a very, very important subject. And I think this is certainly the definitive book. It certainly has a great deal more information than the last excellent book, which was John Toland's. You've been in touch with Mr. Toland?
Oh, yes. I started 18 years ago, and he helped me very much.
Is he still in good health?
No, his health is a little bit poorer now. He suffers from dementia.
Oh, that's such a shame, because yes, he certainly gave us such a wonderful interview when we talked to him, I guess about 5 or 6 years ago, when we first went on the air.
Yes, but I think this illness has curtailed his speaking engagements now.
Well, that's really such a shame. But he had written a number of books. He had written one, Behind the Rising Sun. It was, of course, Pearl Harbor from the a Japanese point of view. In fact, he wrote Toland. He wrote Infamy, and of course he intended to criticize the Japanese in that book, and then the more he read and studied about Pearl Harbor, the more he realized the truth. And of course, as an honest historian, he tried to bring that out, and I thought he did an excellent job. But of course, now that your book is out here, you have so much more information that he did not, and of course you include some of the information that he was able to get to you.
Yes, that is correct. But mainly this key information was withheld from John Toland.
What was the most important thing that he did not get that you actually were able to get? Certainly this 8-point directive from Commander McCollum. What were some of the other things?
He was not able to get any of the intercept background, the intercepts and the radio direction finding bearings obtained by our Navy and the British Navy prior to Pearl Harbor.
And, of course, without that information, it was very, very difficult to ascertain that we really did know where the fleet was, other than this one statement that he had from some sort of a diplomatic attaché, and perhaps that was the gentleman that you were referring to earlier from the Netherlands. Under any circumstances, the attack on Pearl Harbor really was very well carried out from the Japanese point of view. Didn't it have a devastating effect on our airplanes and on our ships? In fact, most of our airplanes never got in the air, did they?
That is right. There were very few that get into the air, though there were about 4 or 5 of them that were, I'm talking about American aircraft, that did chase and shoot down some of the Japanese carrier aircraft north of Hawaii. So Admiral Kimmel knew that they were up there in the north, and should have issued some type of a statement saying that we've located the Japanese fleet and I'm chasing them. If he had done that, I think that would have helped him a lot, but he didn't do that.
Well, of course, I understand that Admiral Thomas Moore was one of those pilots who was there at Pearl Harbor and chased the Japanese back towards the fleet. Have you ever heard that story?
I don't know the names of the U.S. Navy pilots, but they were from, I recall, the USS Northampton. These were float planes that were catapulted from the cruiser Northampton, and they followed the Japanese planes up near Kauai, which is the northernmost Hawaiian island, and shot down the Japanese planes.
Well, we had a Commander Donaldson on with us today on another subject, but he of course, knew Admiral Thomas Moore, who was most recently the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and really revered among naval officers. And he commented that Admiral Thomas Moore had been an ensign during at that time at the attack on Pearl Harbor and was one of those planes that you were talking about.
Yes, it could have been been Admiral Moore. He was a very distinguished naval officer.
Well, now, of course, as you look back on this whole situation, and I know you've tried to look at this impartially, and you've, in some ways in your book, you almost justify what happened, saying, well, it was sort of the end justifies the means. It was perhaps a small price to pay to get into the war. But looking back over almost 60 years, how do you really feel about it?
Well, this is a question that really I'm asked at every book discussion and talk shows. And when you really get down to it, I feel that was probably the only option that our government had, or President Roosevelt had at the time. Some people suggested, well, why didn't we just go out and engage the Japanese fleet north of Hawaii? That would have had the same effect. But, you know, President Roosevelt and Commander McCollum said they wanted a clean-cut, overt act of war to really end this isolation movement. That was the guiding strategy.
And I think that what Stimson had said in his diary, and any of
our
listeners
right.
out there who would like actually to get a copy of that, we'd be glad to provide it for them. I actually copied this back at the Sterling Library. He said, you know, the only question is how we were going to get into the war and get the Japanese to fire the first shot. Well, of course, faced with the cutoff of their all their natural, all of their supplies, all of the minerals and the other supplies they needed for their society, and certainly faced with the cutoff of oil, they had no alternative but to attack. And here was this ideal target, the American fleet right there at Pearl Harbor. And they probably wondered why we didn't move it back to the West Coast, as Admiral Richardson wanted. They thought this was a wonderful opportunity without realizing that, of course, we really didn't care about those battleships. And it gave us a wonderful slogan, Remember Pearl Harbor. Now, of course, Secretary of War Stimson goes to Pearl Harbor, and he just sort of feigned surprise that they had no idea what was going to happen. In other words, they play this little game as if, well, didn't you know that the attack was coming? As if, why, of course we told you. And, of course, that puts Admiral Kimmel into a tremendously defensive position. How soon after the attack is Admiral Kimmel relieved of his command?
He was relieved of his command on December the 16th. So that was, what, about 11 days, or no, about 9 days after the attack.
Right.
And so it was General Short was relieved by the president.
They call that a scapegoat. We've got Lillian on the line. I bet this is Lillian from Pacific Grove.
Hello, Dr.
Hi, how are you doing, Lillian?
Just fine, thank you. You have a brilliant man on tonight that's done an unlimited amount of research and has the courage to come out with it with so many people involved in it. I think it's one of the most horrible setups in the history of the world, Pearl Harbor. But I think it went so much farther with the intention, because didn't Churchill and Stalin and Roosevelt conspire together on the thing?
I really can't say. I'm not in the position. I know that certainly Roosevelt had promised Churchill would be coming into the war. I don't know about the relationship with Stalin at that time.
Well, I think that I think that it was true. And of course, everything in that whole war was just terrible, and it was to help Stalin and Russia and break up Europe. But I think when it's all said and done, they were willing to do the terrible sacrifice in Pearl Harbor to have a one-world government, the League of Nations, so we'd have but fortunately we were able to stop that. But they thought, sure, they'd put that across at that time then, as a result, didn't they?
Well, I suspect that they knew that this was going to result in the United Nations anyway. Okay, anything else, Lillian?
Well, no, not really, but I've always had the feeling that the goal for the one world government through the League of Nations, which of course failed, and then we got the United Nations instead, which is even a worse monster, if that's possible. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lillian. Okay, our telephone number, 464-8295, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and we just dropped off our internet people, but I think that they're calling in. And incidentally, if you're ever out there on the internet, well, I guess the internet people aren't going to hear right yet. We're just about back on internet right now. If you're out there on the internet and we drop off, I don't hesitate to call in because sometimes I get so interested in the conversation that I'm not looking over at the screen. And so we've been off for a couple of minutes. Just give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and the engineer will rush right out and get us back on again. So if you're out there on the Internet and you do lose us, don't hesitate to call 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And, of course, if you're here in the Central Coast of California or out across America listening to us, and you have a question for Mr. Robert Stinnett, author of The Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR, don't be bashful, give us a call, because this is, of course, a very, very significant book, because it's, I think, beyond any shadow of a doubt, it shows that Pearl Harbor was planned. Now, of course, there, as Mr. Stinnett says, many people today say, well, we had to do it. I mean, we had no alternative. How were we going to get into the war if we didn't get the Japanese to fire the first shot and, of course, then rally the American people behind the war effort? And it certainly did a very, very good job. How many ships did we actually lose at Pearl Harbor?
Well, the actual loss were the battleship Arizona, the Oklahoma, and an old battleship called the Utah. Those three were permanently out of the war, but the other six were eventually remodeled and fought in the latter stages of the war.
And how about the planes? How many planes did we lose?
Well, the planes, we lost several hundred aircraft, both in Hawaii and the Philippines. But those were old aircraft. The new planes were just coming off our assembly lines, and Americans flocked to work there, turning out 2,000 planes a month.
Well, it was really an amazing accomplishment. Of course, we were turning out a ship a day. There, and of course, we were producing amazing amounts of military material, not only for ourselves, but for a good old Joe Stalin, and of course, for the English as well. And it was really one of the amazing accomplishments of all time, the mobilization of the American industry for the war effort. At that time, of course, we had the industrial base, we had the steel production. We don't have that anymore. Most of that's been transferred throughout the world. Now, what happened, to the officers, the intelligence officers who withheld information from Admiral Kimmel, were they ever held responsible for not passing on the obvious information that would have made them put them on alert?
No, Admiral. Admiral Kimmel's intelligence officer, Edwin Layton, was kept on the staff by Chester Nimitz, Admiral Chester Nimitz, who took over from Admiral Kimmel and led us to victory in the Pacific. But Layton just had a charmed life. He was never charged or even hinted that he was involved in any way of withholding this information.
Well, I think most people had no idea that there was an organized effort to keep Admiral Kimmel from really knowing what was going on, and the same thing, of course, with General Short.
Well, as I said earlier, Layton, Commander Layton, was appointed by the gatekeeper to be the gatekeeper, you could say, for Admiral Kimmel, because this Admiral Anderson, who was the former chief of naval intelligence, appointed him, and he can control the information flow through to Admiral Kimmel through Layton.
And of course, as you pointed out earlier, Admiral Anderson was very, very close to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he was the one then who was brought in charge of charge of the Navy after Stark was they got rid of Admiral Stark, who was chief of naval operations. So you hate to say it was a conspiracy, but it certainly if it wasn't a conspiracy, it'll doodle one comes along.
Well, I'm sure that if these officers were alive today, they would said they. This was the right thing for them to do. They wanted to unify this country.
Well, of course, I know that Admiral Kimmel said that if he had known what was coming, he would have put his ships to sea. Even though they didn't have any air cover, they might have been hard for the Japanese to find, and at least they wouldn't have been there just like sitting ducks.
Yes, that was an option. But he was following orders, and those came right from Washington. They wanted the fleet kept there at Pearl Harbor.
And, of course, the tragedy was that I don't think Admiral Kimmel really understood what this was all about, as obviously Admiral Richardson had, and that's why he'd gotten himself fired. Obviously, when he told the president that the Navy didn't have much confidence in him, why, that was a sure one-way ticket out of the Navy. But
no question
sometimes,
about it.
Sometimes we need military officers who'll say it like it is. I think the tragedy was he didn't go to the media and tell them exactly what was going on.
Well, of course, the media were told that we were that the United States had broken the Japanese codes and the war was going to start the first week of December. Yes. But they followed their secrecy agreement with General George Marshall there in Washington.
Well, of course, what they did is they withheld information. Now, if you're in the media, you have an obligation to the public. You know, that's what you're there for, not to simply serve the government. And I would really feel very, very strongly that the media bears a great deal of responsibility for what happened. What about Edward R. Murrow? What part did he play in this whole incredible story?
Well, on the night of December 7th, President Roosevelt called Edward R. Murrow, the CBS news correspondent, William Wild Bill Donovan, who was head of the OSS at the time, to the Oval to the White House, to the president's private quarters, and they discussed the attack. And apparently, from the diary of Donovan, they discussed this overt act of war and whether or not it would unite the country. We can trace that to Donovan's diary. But Edward R. Murrow would never reveal what was said there. He said it was the greatest story of his life, but he could never reveal it.
Now, this was Wild Bill Donovan you're talking about?
Yes, there are two of them. Wild Bill Donovan, Edward R. Murrow, and the president met at about midnight on December 7th, and the president discussed whether or not the United States would be unified now as a result of this attack. And apparently they also discussed the overt act, according to the diary.
Okay, and of course, for our listeners, Donovan went on to head the first OSS, which was sort of the counterpart of the CIA, and then after the Second World War, it became the CIA.
Yes.
Now, we have Karen. Karen has a question.
Yes, sir. You know, I've been listening to this interview so very intently, and it's wonderful information. And I have to ask a question that may sound quite naive. I'm younger. I was not alive during World War II, but I have read extensively about the policy our government had toward Japan, which actually all our policies forced Japan into the war, I believe, the treatment of the Japanese in California. The conclusion you came to, that this is what our commanders had to do, quite frankly, again, this might sound naive, but why? Why did we even need to be involved in this war?
Well, as I said earlier, this was the strategy advocated by this Commander McCollum of Naval Intelligence, and was adopted by President Roosevelt as a way to get us into really the European war to fight Hitler, to end the isolation movement. That was the whole strategy, and Commander McCollum outlines that in a seven-page memorandum on October the 7th, and the very next day the president started putting it into operation.
Sir, perhaps I misunderstood you then. I understand that this is the perfect plan then that they contrived to get us in the war, the powers that be. This was the modus operandum that they used, in other words.
That is correct, Karen, and I have it reproduced in the book, and it's really a fascinating document.
In fact, I'm just looking at it here now. In fact, it's really worth the price of the whole book. You'll actually see this marked confidential, but this is Commander McCollum's message to be sent up through the chain of command, a plan to force Japan to attack the United States. And it certainly is a fascinating thing to read, to understand the devious nature of these people, because, of course, they wanted to leave the Pacific Fleet. They specifically said, leave it where it will be in a vulnerable position. Isn't that correct, sir?
Yes, that's correct. The orders were the United States desires that Japan commit the first overt act.
Could we just, let's just go through this quickly, and then I will get Karen back on the line here. I've been making an arrangement with Britain for the use of the British area in the Pacific. Let's see, is that it? I make the arrangements with Holland for the use of the base facilities and acquisition of the supplies in the Dutch East Indies. Are those the 8 points?
Those are one of them, yes.
All right.
Right. There's a series of eight of them. McCollum labeled them A to H. And I think you've just quoted from A and B.
Okay, and then, of course, H is complete embargo, all U.S. trade with Japan in collaboration with a similar embargo imposed by the British Empire.
And that's right, and President Roosevelt signed that, or it was an executive order. He signed it on July 28, 1941.
Right. But, of course, this whole thing was to leave the fleet, keep the main strength of the U.S. Pacific Fleet now in the Pacific in the vicinity of the Hawaiian Islands.
That's why? Action F. Right.
Because that would make it vulnerable for attack. Karen, did you, go ahead.
Well, so this whole thing is an atrocity. What we're talking about here are then thousands and thousands of American men who lost their lives so President Roosevelt and the powers that be could intentionally get us into a war. I mean, that is the bottom line, isn't it?
That was the strategy that was adopted, and many of these officers said it was a, as I quote in the book, a cheap price to pay to unify the United States.
It's an awful price to pay.
Well, that's what the reaction today.
Right. Okay.
Thank you very
anything
much.
Anything else, Karen?
No, that's all. Thank
all
you.
All right, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you agree, you disagree, how do you feel about it? Do you think that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was justified in doing what he did? Do you think it was a cheap price to pay to bring us into the Second World War? Give us a call at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY, because this really is the classic book, and I've read, we must have 8 or 10 books on Pearl Harbor, but this is the one that has certainly the most definitive material in it, and of course it simply is... Mr. Stinnett has been persistent, has finally got some of this information out of the government. They still have 99% of the radio intercepts locked up. Why? Because they have been telling the American people for the last almost 58 years that we had no idea where the Pacific Fleet was, and the Japanese fleet, and we knew exactly where it was. But, of course, if we knew where the fleet was, and we knew it was off the coast of Hawaii, then we knew the attack was coming, and we left those boys to die. And, of course, that is the thing that we cannot let the American people know, because next time we have a war, maybe people aren't going to want to go to have their boys sacrificed. We like to have the idea, boy, if we lose a boy, we're going to go in and get him. That's the message they put out. But here is clear proof that those boys were simply sacrificed on the altar of expediency. Well, you know, as you've studied this thing, isn't there a tremendous emotion involved from your part? I know when I stood there in Pearl Harbor and I looked out at that the mast of the Arizona coming up, I mean, I almost wept.
Yes, and this is the reaction mine too. People said those are the tears of those who died at on the Arizona. And as Karen said, just expressed the outrage that our men had to die in this act. But you know, look at action. See, it's action D there in the book where McCollum suggested sending United States cruisers into Japanese territory. Well, that was done, and President Roosevelt said, "I don't mind losing 1 to 2 cruisers, but I don't want to lose 5 or 6." Well, if you lose 1 or 2 cruisers, each has 900 men. That's about 1,800 men that he was willing to lose, and he's on record for saying that. And that's about what the Navy lost at Pearl Harbor. There were about 1,800 naval deaths. The rest were U.S. Army, Marine Corps, and civilians.
How many altogether? Was it 2,800?
About 2,800 killed, and then there were many wounded and maimed.
Right, and carry the pain of their wounds to their grave. Page 265 is what we're quoting from, and this is, of course, a memorandum, a confidential memorandum from Colonel McCollum to the Director of Naval Intelligence. And Of course, the information is all here, and you'll see the actual duplicates of exactly what went on. Well, what other points do you think we should make as far as this incredible story? What message would you like to leave with the listeners tonight?
Well, I want to really tell the listeners what a great law we have in the Freedom of Information Act. That was introduced by Congressman John Moss of Sacramento, California, and adopted about 15 years ago. And this allows any citizen of our country to file and get this information, and you have the federal courts to back you up. I never had to use the federal courts, or at least I haven't as yet, because I've got the information that I wanted and expect to get more. But I want your listeners to know that we have this wonderful law, and no other country has it. In Great Britain and England, they have an Official Secrets Act, and they can't release this type of information. The British also were intercepting the Japanese fleet, but they cannot release it at all because of the Official Secrets Act.
But isn't there, at least in England, isn't there some sort of a sunshine clause where after 30 or 40 years it becomes available?
Well, that is one clause, but it does not apply to communications intelligence. That's an exemption. Communications intelligence means the interception of enemy or adversary communications.
Okay, fine. Well, of course, I'm just so glad that we were able to get this information and that you were able to put this all together into an incredible story, which, of course, some people may think it's master diplomacy. Other people may think this is simply treachery and betrayal. And, of course, it was such a good idea. Why didn't they come out and tell the American people? If this was a masterful diplomatic maneuver, why have they kept it secret all this time? And why didn't they come out right afterwards and say, hey, we did it?
Yes. Well, you know, this is another observation that people make on the radio talk shows that I'm on and in book discussions. And we don't really have an answer to that because no one in authority were ever asked the question. And as you know, President Roosevelt died in April 1945 before the war ended. And then no one had an opportunity to ask him that question.
Well, of course, we've got Steve calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
How are you doing, Dr. Stan?
Fine.
Yeah, that story that's coming out now, it's really not coming out. This is hard to believe, but when I was growing up, when I was about 15 or 16...
Are you on a speakerphone or something, or a little garbled?
I'm not sure. I have DSL on my phone line. Okay, maybe it's... Let me turn the radio off. Maybe that's getting the feedback better.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was growing up, when I was 15 and 16, my father was telling me the same thing about Pearl Harbor and the things that were going on. And this is not new. The British have used this ploy often. They have been known to sacrifice numbers of people. Remember the Maine. The Maine was another one of these explosions, which was to unite the American people to get behind a war effort. And
don't remember the Lusitania. That was, of course, to be used to get us into the First World War.
And then if you want to take it a little further into Vietnam, the Tonkin Bay Resolution.
Right.
By Johnson.
It's sort of like deja vu all over again, isn't it?
I know it. And they do this over and over again. And the thing now is when I would talk about this and I'd mention something and I said, my father told me this, you know, they'd scoff at me and say, that's not possible. You know, this Americans don't have those kind of values. We would never do something like that. But it's not true.
Well, it's not that the Americans have the values. I mean, the average American is a wonderful person, a unique individual and throughout history. But sometimes we find very wicked people get into positions of power, and of course they're totally unconcerned about human suffering and the loss of other people's lives.
It seems to be like a control type thing. The gentleman you were talking to, I can't remember his name right now.
Mr. Robert Stinnett.
Yes. The media plays an enormous part in this.
I'm going to have to just take a quick break here because the computer tells me it's time to go for a break. Can you stay with us for a few more minutes, Mr. Sinnott?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, and you just hang on there, Steve, and we'll be right back.